views and opinions expressed by callers, guests, and hosts do not necessarily reflect those of the Black Talk Radio Network and Black Talk Media Project. Black Talk Radio is new black media for the new millennium.
Jamal Weed, co-host of Race Treaty, that comes to you every Friday evening between the hours of 9 and 10 Eastern Standard Time. Race Treaty is a program that brings together human rights activists from around the world looking at the question of liberation for people of African descent, and we particularly look at what is called the International Convention to Eliminate Discrimination, ICERD. Tonight's program is one that we're quite proud of for a number of reasons, and you'll see the reasons in the number of persons who will appear. We're on the court, not the court, the basketball court, but we're on the world court of life. And I say that to say because the person who you'll hear next, who I'll introduce first, his name happens to be his last name, Iverson. So when you think of Iverson, we always think of what Philadelphia 76ers and the young brother who did amazing things. Well, we're on the court of life where it really makes a difference. M. Thuntabantu Iverson is a veteran social movement and human rights activist who has participated in the civil rights, black student, black power, African liberation support, New Left, and human rights movements for the majority of his adult life prior to joining the faculty of the Indiana University Labor Studies Department. Thuntabantu worked in several occupations with a number of industries, including health and safety organizer on the international staff of the Service Employees International Union, SEIU, stagehand, and decorated with International Association for Theater and Stage Employees. I didn't know that. And guess what? A coal miner with the United Mine Workers of America, as well as auto worker within United Auto Workers, steel worker with United Steel Workers of America, furniture worker, shipyard worker, butcher, cook, elementary and middle school teacher. I mean, what hasn't this brother done? As well as college adjunct professor. Thuntabantu earned his doctorate from the Department of Political Science at Clark Atlanta University in 2007. His dissertation, Serving in the Shadows, African American Women, Healthcare Workers in Gary, Indiana, from 1980 to 2000. Is an intersectional examination of workplace and union conditions and resistance strategies of black women in the Northwest Indiana. Professor Iverson retired as a senior lecturer from Indiana University in 2014. He currently resides in Denver, Colorado, and works with Black Lives Matter 5280. Building Intersection Frameworks for Human Rights is one of his books. On Patriarchy, Black Feminism, and Radical Voice is another. So we are so happy to have Dr. Iverson on the show tonight, not only as a guest. He's not a guest. He, in fact, is a co-host of Race Treaty. This is his maiden voyage, and he's coming in with a bang. He has a few guests that he will be bringing on from time to time. So at this point, I will be here in support, but everyone please give a good race treaty black talk radio. Welcome to our dear brother, Dr. Tantabantu Iverson. M. Tantabantu Iverson, that is. Welcome, brother.
Thank you, Onaji. Can you hear me?
I can.
Okay. Good evening, sisters and brothers, and thank you, Onaji, for that very unexpected kind introduction. My name is Tantabantu Iverson, and this evening I will be joining with several other activists in a conversation on black people's struggles for economic, social, and cultural rights in the United States. We're very fortunate this evening to have with us Sister Marion Kramer. Marion, are you on? Marion appears to be not yet on. Parents, are you on, right?
Yes, I'm sorry, this is Scotty, the audio engineer. Greetings, everyone. If you're on the board, already called in, just hit star on your keypad to mute and unmute yourselves. But I will go ahead and unmute everyone. Let me go ahead and do that. Just please watch the background noise for the quality of the broadcast. All right, everybody should be unmuted. Please take it away.
Okay, is this Marion?
Can you hear me? All right, we have... Yes, thank you, Marion. We hear you.
All right.
We have Sister Marion Kramer of Highland Park in Detroit, Michigan. Marion is a veteran political activist who was one of the founders of the National Welfare Rights Organization as well as the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. Marion is also currently active in the struggle for the human right to water in Michigan. Welcome, Marion. We also have Brother Terrence Courtney, a veteran organizer around labor rights and the rights of black immigrants in Atlanta. Brother Terrence, are you on?
Yes, sir, I'm here. Thank you.
All right. Finally, we will be joined very shortly by Sister Felicia Griffin, who is the executive director of Fresk Good Jobs Strong Communities. Felicia has been working in metropolitan Denver for the past several years to confront the displacement of working class communities due to so-called development and the enormous housing crisis here in Denver because of skyrocketing rents. Felicia will be joining us shortly. She had a family commitment that she could not deny. So we'll be turning to our panel members very soon. But first, let me welcome everyone. And let me very quickly address a question that a number of folks have been asking lately, and then we'll get right into some discussion with Marion, Terrence, and then Felicia. People have been asking, what are economic, social, and cultural rights? And I just want to briefly just share some information with all of you. Economic, social, and cultural rights are those human rights relating to access to housing, food, water, health care, and education, the workplace, social security, family life, and participation in cultural life. In particular, we're talking about the right to an adequate standard of living, including the rights to food, the right to be free from hunger, the right to adequate housing, and the right to water and to clothing. Never thought we'd have to talk about people needing to have the right to water, but we're going to find out this evening how important that right actually is and how difficult it is to get it. We're also talking about workers' rights, including freedom from forced labor. We're talking about health and safety conditions, the right to join and form trade unions and to strike, the right to Social Security and social protection, including the right not to be denied Social Security coverage arbitrarily or unreasonably. Sound familiar, brothers and sisters? And the right to equal enjoyment of adequate protection in the event of unemployment, sickness, old age, or the likelihood of any other circumstances beyond one's control. So these are just some of the human rights that we're talking about. We might also mention the right to health, including the right to access to health facilities, which is such an important topic for discussion these days, and the right to education. Few, if any, of these rights are guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution. But these human rights are certainly some of the rights for which black people in the United States have had to fight ever since we were brought here in chains. And these are some of the very rights that have been most deliberately denied to us since the onset in the 1970s of the corporate capitalist agenda to remove all obstacles to making the highest degree of profit while also removing any and all protections that we had won throughout the decades of social movement struggles. Let's get right into our discussion with our panelists. Marion, let's come to you first, and then we'll come to Terrence with the same basic question. Marion, please tell us a little bit about the conditions and times in which you and other activists decided to form the earliest efforts around welfare rights. What connections did you see between the black freedom struggle and welfare rights?
Okay, let me correct something in the history that you gave at the beginning. I was around when welfare rights, the National Welfare Rights Organization began. And like always, I wasn't too much, I would never attend things on the internet, on the national scene, because I always loved to stay in the trenches. So I was around, when we formed it, but and stayed around it until they had to close the doors on us. And I was privileged, but you know, you didn't see me out there. You didn't see me too much as far as in some of those pictures that they might have said these are the leaders of that particular movement. But back to the question that you asked. The conditions that gave rise to a national welfare rights organization during that period of time was that, you know, we were just coming out of the civil rights movement that had laid the groundwork and demanded for certain reforms to be won by people that had begun to, particularly blacks being in the forefront, fighting for those concessions, such as better housing, such as better education, all the stuff that you have named. We weren't on it on the national scene. You didn't see us among the women's movement and stuff, but we were fighting for some of the same things and more. I think we fought even much more because we were fighting to eliminate poverty. And it is what led a lot of the women at that particular time into the I was a civil rights worker in Louisiana, in Jonesboro, Louisiana, also where the Deacons for Self-Defense were formed at that time, the Chili Willies and all the rest of them that was there. And, you know, even at that time, the connection was being made to the North as to look, and people coming down, you know, to help us and engage in some of those fights that we were involved in, you know, against the Klans, against the system that which was perpetrating a lot of the stuff in order even at that time, which was not on the news, around Jonesboro and other places, while we in the civil rights movement, one thing that was happening was there was in factories that were moving down there. And what happened at that time, and when Clinton, not Clinton, oh Lord, I get all those kind of people mixed up, when the president at the time started calling all those meetings, this was in the 60s, calling those meetings with the leaders that they recognized as the leaders of the civil rights movement and all that type of stuff. These factories were being built, and it wasn't profitable at that time to those capitalists that existed at that time to have separate bathrooms, colored white males, white female restrooms and all that stuff. That was not serving their base because it was more money that they had to have. So segregation at that particular time within the factory that was being built down there, they it was a thing to industrialize the South. And they, you know, when we started fighting, that was right along their lines, you know, so quite a bit of money was pushed into the Civil Rights Movement. After the Civil Rights Movement, and I know I moved up north to Detroit because we had been offered some people had wanted us to help organize around housing and against urban renewal that was taking place at the time. I began to see that some of the same stuff that we faced in the South, and look here, I know what fascism was looking like in the South, but some of the same things we were facing down there, it was up here, but hidden, in a sense. But what was along all those lines, when you talk about the economic situation, workers were fighting to get in those factories even up here. Factories were developing in the South, and certain things they were using to be able to try to, on the one hand, unite the workers, but at the same time, disunite them and still keep them fighting along, you know, black versus white type of situation. But up here in Detroit and what have you, Detroit, Highland Park, all the industrial areas up here, the fight was to be able to try to get in these factories and for the blacks in particular to be treated as human beings also up here, just like we were fighting in the South for blacks to be treated as human beings and have some of the same rights and what have you. I learned a lot from participating in those struggles because here were people, and I'll be through, here were some folks I had met in the community where I was organizing that had come up here from different parts of the South. And they were so happy to be able to get these jobs because they gave them the opportunity to buy a home as well as a car. They would have pictures of their cars, pictures of their home, sending them back home to the South where people could see how they were beginning to progress. But they did not know that once they bought those homes and their families were, working hard and then making sure that their children would have something when they die, that they were about to face urban renewal. Urban renewal out of those communities because the areas that they had ended up building their homes or buying their homes was the capitalists needed to expand such educational institutions like Wayne State and what have you, and all those areas were rezoned for Wayne State to be able to do what was necessary in order to expand what was needed at that particular time, because Wayne State and a lot of these universities are tied right in with these capitalist class to do some of their technology work. And so we ended up the fight up here also around the economic base that we were facing.
All right, Sister Marion, thank you. Thank you for that very informative thumbnail sketch. I'm going to get right back with you. Brother Terrence, let's get you in on this conversation as well. What were some of the conditions that led you to begin to fight around labor rights? I believe you were in California when you and I met about 15, 20 years ago.
Well, you know, brother, I'd like to even back up further than that.
Okay, go ahead.
The sister's comments really ring true to me. And in many ways, the narrative she lays out is the prelude to the story I want to share, where I really got involved in my kind of what you might call social justice, human rights activism, just after a series of laws and policies that were passed by Bill Clinton in the late 90s, 96, 97, that essentially what one might call the high watermarks for the neoliberal agenda propagated by both parties, both Democrats and Republicans. What you had is a situation that we all are familiar with, where, you know, Clinton and his co-conspirators in the Republican Party passed a series of laws like so-called welfare reform, the policing and mass incarceration laws that laid the groundwork for much of our mass incarceration situation today, and the series of draconian immigrant rights laws that set the stage for the disenfranchisement of undocumented communities. I really got involved in the aftermath of all of that as, in many ways, for personal reasons where, you know, like Brother Tandabantu, I had working class jobs and I was downsized, which really ignited a fire within me because I went through some personal travails because of that. And that moved me to really think deeper about the rights of workers. And quite frankly, you know, before that, I didn't know much about workers' rights or human rights or even unionism. But I did understand when injustice was taking place, and one might call that intuition that I had, and that drove me to pursue how I might get involved and organize with other folks who were concerned about these issues. And that brought me in contact with Service Employees International Union, like Brother Tandabantu. And it's there where I encountered people who were really, for the first time, concentrating on the aspect of human rights that we're talking about today, that is the economic, social, and cultural rights. And that put me in a position to encounter people and to become an organizer, where in Los Angeles and in Atlanta, I worked with working class Black and Latino communities to fight for their right to economic justice in the spheres of healthcare and the public sector. And from that, I really learned the juxtaposition between the Black freedom struggle and human rights. Because what I saw was that as a result of these laws, you know, in many ways, Black workers, so to speak, were on the front lines and facing some of the hardest executions of these laws. When you talk about welfare reform, you're talking about basically forcing working class Black women into low paying jobs to satisfy the neoliberal drive for greater and greater profit extraction. When you talk about mass incarceration laws, what you're essentially talking about is a systematic repression of Black communities in order to maintain a capitalist neoliberal regime, right? You know, in other words, you know, I argue that mass incarceration isn't necessarily about profit and private prisons, because the majority, 90% of most prisons, are government-run. I argue that mass incarceration is actually a tool to control and contain communities like ours, Black communities, who are potential revolutionaries, right? If you could control and contain these communities through mass incarceration and hyper-policing, then you're better able to maintain this neoliberal regime. And finally, when you talk about the laws that have set the stage for, you know, immigrant rights repression here, that also was a part, because I argue that in many ways, U.S.-born Africans are in the same boat that foreign-born immigrants. That is to say that, when you think about it, U.S.-born African-Americans don't really have the luxury of saying, well, you know, we are citizens, because everywhere you look, we always have to fight for our so-called civil rights. You know, we always are faced with conditions where our civil rights, so-called civil rights, are taken away from us, or we're somehow disenfranchised. So I actually don't believe that U.S.-born people of African descent are really considered citizens by the United States. And that's opinion is based on practice, not any kind of, you know, fluffy idealism. So that really spurred me, and that connected the dots for me, and that really set me on a trajectory where I started organizing in Los Angeles, California, around economic and social justice. And then I came back to Atlanta, and I co-founded a couple of organizations, one of which was the local chapter of Atlanta Jobs and Justice, where we brought together civil rights organizations, human rights organizations, student groups, unions, and faith organizations to challenge various examples of violations to our economic, social, and cultural rights. Afterwards, I co-founded an organization of which I'm still a part of called the Atlanta Public Sector Alliance, where we specifically targeted what we call the public good. And what I'm talking about is we saw that in order to help beat back a neoliberal regime whose one aspect of its strategy was to transfer public wealth, that is public infrastructure, public taxes, public goods to private hands, we fought against that on the fronts of issues related to health care, issues related to our right to education, our right to housing, our right to good jobs, our right to public transportation. I mean, one of the cornerstones of our piece that I think was exceptional is that in the 21st century, we argue that public transportation, high quality public transportation, is a human right, right? And that is corroborated, I think, by Article 13 of the Human Rights Doctrine that talks about how human beings have the right to move freely throughout the globe without interference. So that put me on a trajectory that I still am on, and I want to talk more about that as the show goes on.
Thank you very much, Brother Terrence. Sister Felicia, are you on? She has not yet. I don't believe Sister Felicia has joined us as yet. So let's go back to Marion for just a moment. Marion, please tell our listening audience a little bit about how you got involved in the fight for the human right to water in Highland Park, in Detroit, and in Flint, Michigan.
Let me start off. Dante Bantu, you know you're going to have to guide me to what you want. We could stay here all night long.
Just tell us a little bit about what it was that got you involved in the fight for, of all things, the human right to water in Highland Park.
Well, you know, dealing with welfare rights, people come, and we're the Union for Poor People. And back in the late 90s, 1990s and stuff, some people were coming into our welfare rights office saying they were having problems with shut off with utility. And one day I looked at the person I worked with a lot, and that's Maureen Taylor. I said, Maureen, let me teach you on this. I said, I bet you that and each time a person come in this office with these problems that they have, it's more than just the problem that they named when they came in, their food samples. It's probably a lot of more things, given the situation that people are forced to live in the United States below the poverty line. Let's start checking that. And true enough, I said, I bet it's some water problems, too. They were coming in dealing with one problem and still had a lot of other problems, and one of them was water. And this was in the late 90s. We started pulling this out of people, and it was getting cold. It was one of the coldest years. And we came together, and I said, look, let's, we discussed, she and I was discussing, maybe we need to start organizing against the Water Department of Detroit. And we did. we wanted certain things answered. They wouldn't answer us. So we went to Marianne Mahaffey, who was on city council, who called a task force meeting of the water department, the other various agencies and organizations, even the governor's office, and said, I want to form this task force because there's a problem that has come to us from Welfare Rights that people are having problems with their water. And not only with their water, I need some report from the water department as to how many people are you shutting off given the coldness, cold weather out here at, you know, at this particular time. And we had to have several meetings to dig that out of these suckers. And I call them, still call them suckers. Several meetings. Even the people that's supposed to be governing them, they didn't even respect them enough to give them the information that went in. So we dug, we kept messing with them until they finally came out and said that there was over 7,000 or some people in the city of Detroit that were facing shut off or have been shut off. Now, the people that's on the water board didn't even know that. And why were they shutting them off? Because they would tell a person that if you cut, when you go in and you have a high water bill, you got to pay a third of that water bill. So if you got a water bill that's $1,000, you got to pay a third of that in order to get the water back on. And you're only receiving welfare. And like the brother prior to me saying, that I was there with that welfare reform and fighting against Clinton and what he did, talking about he was going to change welfare as we knew it. And he did change it. He changed because he didn't, and I'm getting right to it now. They did not, at the same, all this stuff was going on at the same time. They were cutting back on the safety net. And one of the things, if you test anywhere in the United States, people as far as that water situation, a lot of times tend to be quiet and won't say too much. My water is shut off. Well, why is your water shut off? You know, well, I didn't pay my bill. Well, how much do you get from the welfare department? Did you go in there to apply for emergency needs? The emergency program or anything like that? Yes, and they said they can't pay but $80-some. But my water bill, or $90-some, my water bill is $500, you know. We had to, those are some of the problems we were being presented with. We were being presented with the fact that people were afraid that their children would be snatched. Because if you don't have water, and you don't have also other utilities at the same time, then they snatch those kids saying that they're living in a dangerous situation. And this was not coming out, but movement has been bringing that out. Furthermore, we, you know, this went on for quite a while. We fought in Detroit and tried to get stuff changed and what have you. And after we won a few little reforms from the water department there, we decided that we were going to, with the three organizations that were working together, that we were going to get somebody in here that could write up a water affordability plan. We went all the way to Boston and found this attorney, fundraised for that, and brought him in. And this man dug deep and came forth with a water affordability plan. And look, if we'd have had probably some pistols at that time, it'd have been probably been a shootout at the OK Corral, because the water department was not going to implement that kind of program. You know, right. That was, and we're still fighting that. Because what we start, what the key thing, what we start exposing in Detroit was that, hey, you have all these corporations, and they hardly don't even pay a water bill, but yet still you would cut all these people in Detroit water off and not cut off the corporation water. If they paid their bill, you wouldn't have no economic problem down there. But they rather go to the people who they didn't give a damn about, you know, and freeze them, take their children, and have them running around here like, you're out of your mind. How am I going to get my children back? And so we were facing all that type of stuff, and we are facing it. I don't care if the mayor was black, white, red, or green. Kwame was in there. And Kwame also was saying, no, Kwame Kilpatrick.
Yes, yes.
He refused to stay on that water department and stop them. They, in the wintertime, no water should be shut off. And in fact, if people don't have no money, why they don't have any money? Because they don't need them to work like they used to here. Not only just here, technology has advanced to the point that people are not needed as much as that they needed at one time in these factories. These factories, at one time they used to, when they began to bring those robots and stuff, and that was enhanced the ability of the worker to produce more. Now the robots are there, and the worker enhanced the robots to produce more. So, you know, here you have workers and all, I'm talking about workers in the factory, that are also facing some of these problems. But they keep it quiet because we have been taught in society we're not going to let people know if we're having some of these problems because it makes me look bad. But we're constantly fighting to bring it out.
Mary?
I'm sorry. Huh?
Yes, let me just ask this. Did you not, all of you who are fighting around this issue in Detroit and Highland Park, did you not fairly recently have some sort of an international representative of the United Nations offer an assessment of the situation in Highland Park in Detroit?
Well, Dr. Monte, you know we done everything.
I know, but our audience needs to know that we are fighting. Okay.
We have not only brought the UN and got the UN to come in here and to evaluate the situation in Detroit as well as Highland Park. But they wrote it up. You can get a report of that, of the visit to Detroit. And plus they looked at housing when they were here. Because right now Detroit's got so many vacant lots that you could bring Boston in here and lose it. When Flint's situation went down, and the fact that they didn't move the people in Flint out of that situation like they have done with people in Fraser, Michigan here, and they could have brought people up here to live in Detroit until they got Flint, if they wanted Flint to be, you know, rebuilt and what have you. They would have had access to good water. They would have had access to the fact that they would have heat and all that type of stuff. And those kids probably wouldn't have been contaminated like they are now. Now, they didn't do that for Flint. Because Flint, like Detroit, Flint, like Highland Park, Flint, like Benton Harbor, Flint, like Inkster, Michigan, all of us have had emergency managers over us that have sold off anything the cities might own and give the corporation the opportunity to do what the hell they want to here. We have been robbed of campgrounds. We have been robbed of the zoos and everything that the cities might, you know, own. The private the jewel of Detroit was Belle Isle, where the workers and their families would go out there in the summertime. You'd be out there all night fishing or having a party, you know. They have sold that. They have let the state take that over for 99 years, and we have to pay now to go on bailout. So everything that has been on the back of the workers and that we have won over the years, whether it was against environmental injustice in the factory or in the community, they have began to take and erase it from the books. And you find out about it later on. And the key thing, the most important thing, like when you look at Flint, up there, they have been, the corporation up there, they have been stealing land for the longest, trying to get that pipeline to come through there. and doing all this fracking, because you need water to do fracking.
Yeah.
And they've been stealing land up there and killing off the people up there, because a lot of those people have not are still living like that with those rusty ass pipes coming in and out. We don't know. We got to do the same thing here, even in Highland Park in Detroit, and that is run some more tests on folks to find out how much effect that. And I leave you with this, because I can go on all night. There. Here in Highland Park, the graveyard of Henry Ford, you know, he built a pumping station when he was building the first assembly line over here. And that pumping station, that water, the purpose of that was not to be able to have to go through Detroit, because we live in the middle of Detroit. And they've been trying to get that water ever since the assembly line was shut down years ago. But when I say they, I mean Detroit, to consolidate Highland Park into Detroit. And they have gotten rid of everything over here that meant something to the people here. And Highland and everything, you can't hardly afford the housing, let's more on the water thing. We're in a big fight here now to try to get our water back, you know, be control of our own water. You don't pay your property taxes. You don't pay your property taxes. It's immediately transferred to your water bill. So not only will they'll be able to take your house from you, but at the same time set you out based on the fact that you can't pay the water bill and you can't pay the taxes. So therefore, they have moved to evict a lot of people, and a lot of these young people can't afford these houses no more. And so, what we're looking at, what kind of reforms could we fight for to be able to stop this wave that is taking place throughout Michigan right now? They are illegally, and I'll leave you with this: City of Highland Park had the best school system in the state. And mainly, Highland Park is, percentage-wise, is mainly all black. But that ain't what I'm looking at right now. And that is that because they did it to another place that was mainly all white, and they didn't put it in the news. They changed all our school, our whole school system, to charter schools. Only 80 to 90% of the children in those schools now are from children from around the metropolitan area in Highland. None of the children in Highland Park go to those schools. But we are made to pay the property tax for these schools that our own kids,
Marian,
do not attend. Huh?
Marian, you have given us you've given us a tremendous amount to think about. I want you to hold off just for just a moment, because I know Terrence is going to have to be leaving in about 15 or 20 minutes. So let me switch over to Brother Terrence. Terrence, talk about your struggle. I mean, Marian has talked very much about the attack on the public good of water in the state of Michigan. Does any of that sound familiar to you, looking at the conditions in which the Atlanta struggle has been developing for public good?
Well, absolutely. I mean, not necessarily, you know, word for word in terms of the water issue, because as of yet has not come to the fore. But I mean, essentially what she's talking about is how capitalism's latest strategy, called neoliberalism, is actually excavating and extracting and decimating public infrastructure, public health, public water, you name it, these public goods, which are in other words human rights, for profit. And the same is taking place throughout the United States, but I'll just talk about Atlanta, for example, where here in Atlanta, 1935, Franklin Delano Roosevelt was forced to experiment with a project for public housing. You know, in 1935, because of the enormous organization and protest of left activists forcing the administration to the left, he realized that, you know, the human right, though it wasn't called the human right at that time, but we realize that now, the human right to housing had to be dealt with. So he experimented with a project in Atlanta called public housing, and it was called Techwood Homes, and from there it spread throughout the nation. Well, here in Atlanta now, there is no public housing whatsoever. People have been forced into private markets through the use of so-called vouchers. Here in Atlanta, you know, the key hospital that was 100 years old that served the poor, called Grady Memorial Hospital, which was a public hospital paid by tax dollars, has been privatized by Citigroup and other forces. Here in Atlanta, when you talk about a city mired in deep traffic and road and infrastructure problems, we lack adequate public transportation, which we argue is a public right as well. Public transit is very limited. Here in Atlanta, when you talk about public schools, just like you know, the sister before me talked about, charter school proliferation is abound. In fact, organizers here in the state had to beat back a statewide referendum that was on the ballot, which, if passed, would have given the governor monarch-like powers to destroy public schools he deemed failing and charterize and basically privatize. I don't consider charter schools public schools. They're really private charter schools that use public dollars to resource themselves. Fortunately, yeah, that was beaten back. But as we know, conservative and liberal forces don't rest easy. So they're going to come back. But those are some of the human rights challenges we face in the public sector, and resistance is taking place on every front. But, you know, as the sister alluded to, it's very difficult for resistance forces due to the fact that we lack money, we lack time in many ways. Many of our communities are in a trap of neoliberalism, capitalism, where they have to work long hours for low wages. And so that actually extracts time from our movement. So the struggle continues, but I think the great thing about this conversation is that what we're trying to do and what we're succeeding in doing, I think, from my listening, is that we're helping folks understand that human rights is not just this idealistic set of principles reserved for New York and Geneva and so forth. Each day, there are people all around the country fighting for human rights. They may not use that terminology, but in essence, they're fighting for people's human right to health care, housing, education, a decent life, and opportunity to be fully human. And that struggle is very real.
In the time that you have left, Terrence, then I'll give the same question to Mary and hope that Felicia is on board with us. Say a word, if you will, Terrence, about what you think is one of the most important things that activists, particularly Black activists, can do in this present moment to further build social movement around, with an explicit understanding of human rights.
Brother, that is the key question for our time, and with as much modesty as I can put forward, I do think I have some ideas, and I think one of the things that we have to struggle with at this moment in time are the questions of base building and strategy. The Trump era, and even just preceding it, we saw a great deal of mobilizations around any number of issues. But what I want to suggest at this moment in time is mobilizing, you know, as Kwame Ture would say, is not the same as organizing. You know, having 10,000 people march for issue X is okay, but we have to understand that what organizations intent on realizing human rights to its full extent, or even going further toward a radical revolutionary of ideas, principles, and practices, what we have to start to do is really look back and understand that, you know, successful fundamental transformations in histories always occurred because oppressed people were able to build significant bases and they were well organized. And I think that's what we have to do today. We have to actually start to think for a moment about what are the strategic goals and objectives we have, and not just, you know, conduct rallies, marches, and even sometimes civil disobedience. I think we have to start to think more carefully about our goals and objectives and struggle with our colleagues and our comrades who have not yet reached the point where they're starting to think very carefully about this problem. If we aren't able to get past this postmodern era that fetishizes expression and mobilization, I think it's going to be a harder struggle for us. I think we have to realize that, you know, media coverage, though helpful, isn't the key to really having some kind of transformational thing happen. We have to get back to basics, like the sister said, in some ways operate local, but the great thing about human rights is that it is not limiting in the sense that we can operate locally and at the same time understand that our struggles are international. And that's the great thing about human rights, because when you talk about human rights, what you're talking about are not rights rendered by a nation or a state or some local municipality. We're talking about those rights which we're entitled to based on simply nothing more than our humanity, rights which we do not have to earn.
Right.
Rights which are ours because we're human beings, and I'm excited about the potential for that more and more.
Well, brother, thank you so much for the work that you're doing. Please continue. And if you have to jump off, we would really love to have you in another program to continue this conversation with our people about, you know, building the struggle for human rights. Marion, please take away and just talk a little bit about what you think is important for our people to understand that, you know, the fight for human rights in this moment.
Well, even going back to when we got the UN to finally come in here, these young ladies were tremendous. And they not only listened, but they really concluded that saying, like, you know, in like any struggle, you have to constantly write your summation in order to go to the next level. But this human rights fight, the human rights fight has always, you know, within welfare rights, when Dottie Stevens first brought it to us about it, we've been fighting around human rights for a long time. You know, I know the National Welfare Rights Union that we founded years later, we had like a 6-point program, and it was all based on our understanding of human rights. You know, that number one, we should have the rights to, that's implemented to the universal health care. knocking out all these damn corporations, capitalist corporations and stuff like that. No one should be making a profit off of our misery. You know, you understand what I'm saying? It lays and it lays the foundation for us to even have more jobs. The doctors could work freely, but at the same time, dedicated to the public and right. and that type of stuff. So, you know, those are the type we, you know, and I wanted to bring that up, the different things that we talked about, housing, education, the same thing we've always talking about when it comes down to human rights. This should be a basic right everywhere. This is, in the last few years, the struggle around and human rights, and because people more and more are becoming aware of this, have united quite a few people together. I know around this water question, we've been on with folks I never thought we would be on with, you know. But first of all, and I agree with this brother about the whole question of I've preached this a lot in the past about mobilization and organization, you know, organizing. Because when you look at that, you know, in order for people to understand that, they got to be educated. I do believe political education. I'm talking about getting elected and stuff. Today's date, what we're finding out here, we're beginning to see today's fascism and what it's all about. And it's based on this economic situation that these suckers are protecting and trying to get our water and don't need us no more to work for them. So, you know, we set up one day and had a panel on racism, and people, it was packed. They were amazed that some of the things that they have been feeling about, that other folks were feeling about the same thing, because of the way that we've seen laws being taken away that's supposed to protect our rights. We have seen a whole, all this stuff, this fool at the helm in D.C. is doing now with the corporation that has taken over the country and stuff like that, and the violation of our human rights. And you know, and even teaching black folks, our people, teaching them when they don't take a stand against this whole thing that this fool is doing in D.C. around immigration, and trying to send somebody back to some country, their country and stuff, that their butts could be next on your human rights is violated as long as you let him get away with those type of things. You will be next and what have you. But people don't comment to that by them. You got to not only got to experience some of this stuff, but at the same time, they got to be taught. Because they have to understand how to dot the line and understand that, God damn it, you a leader out here. So also, this is what is happening economically. This is why what has been happening economically. This is why they are changing the laws now, and why is this happening now? You know, and I'm saying this is what we're pushing for a lot here, and that is we got to educate the next generation. Not only just the next, this is our duties as elderly brothers and sisters to do this. They have to understand what they are facing. None of us has ever faced this before in our lives. So the pews are open, and I hope we have more discussions like this in order for us all to get some more and more clarity on how we take the next step. And still just as you say, mobilizing, but organizing and sticking and staying. And then I can, when I do go to join my husband, General, at least I could say I did all I could do. And that is, so that's me tonight, Tanti Bonjour. And I'm enjoying this conversation. All right. I hope we have you. And furthermore, I'm going to have to cut off soon.
All
right, well, we thank you. And when you have to cut off, we understand. But thank you so much. And it, I think you're leading us right into Felicia. Felicia, are you on?
I'm sorry, we need to take our station identification break. If you will take us to the break, please.
So we'll have to go for station identification, apparently, at this point. And then we'll come back.
Black Talk Radio, since 2008, providing new black media for the masses. And we are back. You're tuned in to Race Treaty on the Black Talk Radio Network. Join us every Friday night for a live broadcast at 9 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time. For any of the past programs, just check the archives of Race Treaty on the platform. You will find a lot of great content in archives. Guys.
Thank you, Scotty. Brother Najee, are you still on?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, brother. I think that you can take us on in. We need to, you know, wrap this up because I don't think Sister Felicia is going to be able to get on. And I think we just about exhausted the content we have for this evening, but I certainly hope that we can do this next week and perhaps have even some more programs dedicated to this because, as you can see, our people are experiencing some horrendous situations, but then again, our people are putting up a hell of a fight, and we have much more fight in us as we look forward.
Yes, yes. The two guests gave us a good historical framework to look at what's happening with to our people and how capitalism is attempting to extract the marrow, the marrow, not just the blood, but the marrow from our bones. So it is so important for us to continue to organize, and organizing is connecting people, making sure that people's problems and obstacles they are faced that's put in their way by capitalism is in fact communicated and organized around the powers is with the people. We heard some victories, some hard fought and hard won victories over the years, but it's always a question of remaining vigilant so those victories won't go away, and how these back door, closed door, back room deals are being made. And when they get surfaced, that's when you find out, the thief has gone, come in the night, has stolen what he wanted and left out. So we have to stay vigilant. To the listening audience, we want you to stay connected. Let folks know about this program every Friday. This is not just a question of talk, it's a question of organizing. So we need folks to be aware of how these people in different places are organizing, and that we will continue to fight and we will win. Brother Irvin Davis said, we will win only if we continue to struggle, promote the Tutu Ascender. And that's where we are right now. So we're looking at the very basics of life. We're talking about water. We're talking about food. We're talking about housing. We're talking about the rights.
Brother Anat.
Yes, sir.
Brother Najee, I think Sister Felicia just came on. She had a family obligation, but I believe she has just joined us. Maybe she can offer a few words as we're, you know, headed toward the house. Felicia?
Well, yeah, we have, you know, we have another hour if she has the time, if you have the time. So we took a station break, which is customary when we do 2 hours like this. So if she has the time, okay, we can definitely give her the opportunity to, you know, to speak, to share with us what's going on in her part of the woods.
All right, Felicia, are you on?
I sure am. Good evening, everyone. Can you hear me?
Good evening, Felicia. Yes, we can hear you very clearly. Thank you for making the effort to join us this evening. We just had Marion Kramer from Detroit and Terrence Courtney from Atlanta talking about the violations of human rights that they are witnessing and experiencing in those areas of the country. And they also have helped us to begin to understand much more about the struggles that people are waging in those areas for the respect and protection and fulfillment of our human rights. You have been one of the most instrumental people here in the Metro Denver area fighting for human rights. And if you will, Felicia, tell us a little bit about the conditions that prompted you to become involved with FRESC, Fighting for Good Jobs and Strong Communities here.
Right. Well, I guess I could say this struggle is in my DNA. My father was a Black Panther and my mom a hippie and met in the civil rights movement. So even though I tried to dodge this bullet and go into the private sector, it caught me about 15 years ago. And I've been dedicating my career and my life to social justice ever since then. I would say that, you know, I became the executive director of FRESC, Good Jobs, Strong Communities, about 4 years ago. And, you know, in my heart and soul, I wanted to really figure out how to have positive impact, especially for job creation, for my own community and other communities, but specifically for the African American community. And, you know, really had my eye on several policies, raising minimum wage, really looking at the trades and apprenticeship programs and seeing how we can open the doors to jobs that pay living wages. And so I would say, you know, where I was at then was really focused on policy development and policy creation. But, you know, over the last couple years, even before our new administration took over, we've been hit with a housing crisis that, you know, really has, even though it's not a direct target, it feels like a direct target and war on African-American community in Denver. I moved here when I was 11 years old. We had strong showing in the center of the city and in other parts of the city. I just heard some stats lately that the census is probably going to show the African-American community in Denver down from like 11% to something like 1 or 2%. And you know, it's our folks that have been moved out of the city, either to the fringes and the suburbs, or even out of the state because it's unaffordable, and because our neighborhoods have been targeted for gentrification and resettlement of white community from the suburbs. And so, you know, I feel like we're at war. My organization is a hybrid organization and does policy and organizing, and it has been extremely hard to find our people. Our people are not, you know, our traditional.
No, just listen.
On, we've got one, which is a professional neighborhood, where a lot of our teachers and our law enforcement officers and our federal employees live. But there is almost nowhere in the city where you can go and feel our culture and the African American presence. So that's why this call was really excited to me. I don't think I have an hour of content for you tonight, but you know, our community, especially in Colorado, is in crisis. We have dedicated this year because of that, and also because of the new administration that threatens to totally diminish our democracy and our freedom, to organizing. We feel like that is going to be the power and the magic bullet that we need. We need to build power in communities of color, especially the African American community. So that's kind of an intro of where we are.
I would like to share something with you, Felicia. This is Scotty. I'm the audio engineer and station manager. You mentioned something about fighting for a living wage. I'm very familiar with the Fight for 15 movement. Of course, we know that was a campaign issue in 2016 of a federal minimum wage. But I just want to make people aware, while it's on my mind, of how some of the cities that do raise their minimum wage to $15 an hour is impacting those who don't live in those areas. Now, my daughter works for a national company called Children's Place. Children's Place cut her hours, or all the employees' hours, not giving them 40 hours anymore, cutting them to 35. The reason given was is so that they could, because of their stores on the West Coast being forced to pay $15 an hour to those employees. So that's how the this one corporation, I can only speak on that one corporation, but that appears to be a strategy on how they are combating that wage hike. And my daughter was very upset by that. So I just wanted to share that so that that be on people's radar, that that's what corporations are doing. They're cutting the hours of their employees in states so that they can compensate for the higher minimum wage in other states. Thank you.
And of course, Brother Scotty, thank you for that contribution, because what you're pointing to is something that we know about very well, right, Felicia? We see people being divided and conquered over and over and over and over again. And so now, because we have so many people fighting for a living wage, this strategy has been brought back out to try to figure out ways in which people can be divided with this logic, which says, well, we can't do for you because we have to do for all these folks over here. Felicia, can you say a little bit about the Fight for 15 here in Metro Denver?
Yes. So I'm not sure if everyone on the call knows, but we run and win a minimum wage campaign, not for 15, but for 12. We barely won it by 5%. This past November, and it's 12 by 2020, and will impact about 400,000 people across the state, and about 75,000 African Americans. And so, even though it's a pretty modest win, some of the same things that you were saying were the same things that our opposition was saying, but all of the research that we did and that we pulled did not show that raising the wages to these amounts was going to hurt business. Matter of fact, we know that the more money in the hands of low-income folks, the more money that goes into our economy. And so actually, raising the wage in Colorado, our projections show a $1 billion boost to the economy. And so, you know, we as the community really have to, you know, begin talking with our friends and our family and really begin telling the truth, right? You know, a lot of this is by design. It's designed to keep us trapped and where we are and dependent on, you know, the systems and making sure that the folks get richer. I would say one of the most things I've been excited about this year, besides organizing, is we have done some research with an organization, and if you get a chance across the country, it's called Little Sis, and it's in New York. And they have a public database where they are collecting lots of information on corporations and kind of the dirt that they do. And so we ended up doing some research in Colorado about some corporations that we're calling the Bad 11, that are bad for low-income communities, bad for people of color, bad for, you know, it's new, it's very new for us, but we've had two corporate targets this year, Goldman Sachs and Disney, and we also called out folks that were potentially building the new wall between Mexico and the United States. And so, you know, one thing that we've learned is that we have really got to begin. We spend a lot of time punching on our legislators and our elected officials, but we got to look up and see who the puppet masters really are, right? And I totally agree with the brother that said, you know, it's the corporations. And I don't know how you can sit there and cut people's hours when you're still making millions and billions of dollars in profits. And so when we talk about our human rights and our humanity, they're lost, right? And we have got to rebuild and regain them. And what's really interesting to me as well, Brother Tonta Bantu was in a meeting with us where there were some community members and lots of union members, so folks from all facets of community, right, and also different income spectrums, right? And everyone was in small groups, but almost every group, you know, is starving and looking for, you know, how we restore our humanity and our human rights. Like, this is resonating with real people. And so how do we turn this into a movement? And also, how do we turn it into a movement for people of African descent? How do we, I mean, we have got to bridge our elders and our young folks together. So the NAACP and Black Lives Matter, we have got to build a bridge because, you know, the only way that we're going to make it is together. And it's time. It's time for the next civil rights movement, whatever we end up calling it. But it's really to fight. I mean, we're fighting for our very lives.
Felicia, I think you have brought us to a point where we can be reminded of what Dr. King was saying before he was murdered. In the year, in the 2 or 3 years before his untimely assassination, Dr. King had reached a point where he was saying, Felicia, essentially what you are saying now. He was saying that that people in this country face a cruel and unjust system. And Dr. King made the point, and it made him very unpopular with a number of people. As a matter of fact, Dr. Vincent Harding wrote a book about Dr. King, The Inconvenient Hero. And the Dr. King who talked about the dream in the early 60s, that's the Dr. King that many people want to hold on to. But Felicia, I think what you have said and what Terrence has said and what Brother Scotty and what Sister Marion have pointed out, I think comes up to where Dr. King was when he died, when he was calling for a poor people's campaign that would bring together all people from all walks of life, but mainly talking about the dispossessed, the wretched of the United States, the underprivileged, the oppressed, and telling us that we had to have a revolution, not only a revolution of value, but a revolution of political structures that deny us our human rights every single day. And so I think that I think we've pretty much come to a point where we need to look toward our next program, where we will be continuing our discussion about economic, social, and cultural rights. Thank you so much, Sister Felicia. Thank you, Scotty, for the technical the political education content. And please, Brother Onaji, close us out.
Well, I want to thank all our guests, and also thank you, Brother Brother Tonta Bantu. This has been indeed a groundbreaking show. You came in as a co-host, and you just control and just took it to a higher level. And that's what we want to do. For our listening audience, please be aware that we are now organizing co-hosts from each region of the country. We are looking at the decade, the international decade for people of African descent, 2015 to 2024. And in this time, we're looking at the themes of recognition, of justice, and of development. And in that recognition is to be recognized as a people living in a colonial status, domestic colonialism. We're fighting for our rights, collective rights, in international law that's called national minority, people who have been on the land prior to the establishment of a particular government, a particular nation-state structure. We were here before that, and in fact, many years ago, centuries, in fact. So we are fighting for our right to self-determination and fighting for our right for development. But we see that we have some obstacles to overcome in this continuous battle for our liberation struggle. And we're going to continue to fight. Why? Because we're going to continue to organize for our children, for our progeny that is coming after us, and for the little ones who are here now. So we will continue to add co-hosts in different regions. Now we have a representative from the Denver region at Colorado, Midwest, and we'll continue to build that. And because of our experience, we have been in different places around the country, so we only not only represent that particular geographical location that we may be living in right now, but also all of the struggles we've been involved with from the different places that we've lived. So when we put all that together, we'll have continuous information, and this is Black Talk Radio Network, here to serve our people in a way to guarantee our human rights, to fight for these human rights. So I want to thank you, Brother Dr. Banjo, for you coming on, joining us as a co-host, the people that you brought on, and certainly we will ask him to come back on from time to time to give us updates in their struggle and see how this connected. It's really connecting all these struggles. I met Brother Dr. Bantu in Washington, D.C. about a year ago when we attended a conference on human rights cities, which is a movement which is underway of another way of organizing the people, whereby on a local level we're saying to the city councils, to whatever the local legislation is, bring in those international covenants, the way that Chicago brought in covenant on the child. Bring in those international covenants the way that is happening in Eugene, Oregon. Bring in those human rights covenants wherever you are, and that's where you're organizing. And it's not just the question of putting pen to paper, but it's actually talking to people, organizing people around what these rights are and how they must be demanded. You know, Frederick Douglass said it, you know, right, you know, it may be a moral struggle, it may be a physical struggle, but it must be a struggle, because where there is no struggle, there is no progress. So we know that we will continue to do that. So I'd like to thank our co-hosts on this first program, but guess what? There's going to be a part two next week. So all of you, tell your friends, tell your family, tell all of your co-workers to listen in next week as we continue this conversation on economic and cultural rights for our people. And to the listening audience, I'd like to say thank you. Tune in next week and have a good night.